Okay, tonight, I want to start off reading basically here with Revelation 22. The reason I'm choosing this passage is because, and I'm looking really 1 through 5, is because when we were looking at our passage this morning in the sermon, Revelation 2:7 speaks of the tree of life. And it's interesting, for each one of the promises that occur in the churches, there's a fulfillment that occurs towards the end of the book. So you got the promises up front, and as you get to the end of the book, those are fulfilled at the end of the book. And here's an example of the fulfillment of Revelation 2:7 and 22, chapter 22, 1 through 5. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb, through the middle of the street of the city. Also on either side of the river, the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. No longer will there be anything accursed, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads, and night will be no more. They will need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light. And they will reign forever and ever. That's just awesome. I can't wait to get there. Yes, it may be next year sometime, actually. Because, I mean, at the rate we're going, it probably will be. But that's pretty awesome. I mean, you read that, you're just like, wow. And, you know, this morning, as I preached, and I was talking to Danny about it a little bit, from what we've been studying here on our understanding of an early date of Revelation, did you see how that impacted what I preached this morning? And Danny, you're nodding, so help him out a little bit.
The timing meant everything.
Timing meant everything for how we understood what was going on. Yeah, absolutely. For example, the name of the star, Timothy. If we held to a 95 date, there's no way we could do that. As far as the particular things that were going on in the Ephesians church, we've got some really good idea. Remember, I was quoting from, you know, what Paul told the Ephesian elders was going to happen. We looked at then we've got 1 and 2 Timothy, of course, that were going on and the things that are addressed there. So if you go back and you read from those epistles, and then you go and you read there what happened in Ephesus, and then you read from 1st, 2nd Timothy and Ephesians, and then you go and you read what he's saying and what John is saying there in 2, 1 through 7, all of a sudden you're like, I know these people. I know that it's not some, well, we don't really, no, we know these people because they're discussed in the scriptures. And so I was able to preach the sermon as I did this morning because I felt like I was handling familiar territory, having studied those particular passages of the scripture and knowing that this just falls shortly after that, the very elders that Paul warned were very likely still in office when John wrote this. I mean, that's awesome to think about the implications. Can you see the difference that it makes in even understanding that passage within circa AD 65 understanding of the date versus a 95. It changes everything when we go through and understand. So I wanted to just point that out and hopefully y'all had seen that. There's more to think about there, but just an example of why when we date this book is important for understanding. And so today I wanted to look at Irenaeus a little bit. I've mentioned him several times. I actually consider just not doing it because I do like to focus, you know, just on the scriptures. But this is important to help us understand why you're going to read stuff whenever you pick up a book on the Apocalypse of John and it has in there written AD 95 and then what they write about it is from a perspective from then. This is extremely important because for where they come from. And you need to understand this so that it further confirms in your mind what I've been showing you as far as when the book was dated. So go ahead, Mark, hit that one. So we've looked at this slide several times, internal and external evidence, right? And we looked over the last couple of evening sessions, some of the internal evidence, which is the self-witness of the inspired text. It is the most important witness as to dating. And there are numerous ways you could have gone there. I focused on two, really. Do you remember what they were? What was Revelation 11 about? The temple is still standing. What about Revelation 17? What did we look at? Who's the emperor? Nero. And we looked at it. I showed you. Laid it out for you. We also took a look at the 666 to show that the answer is Nero. Nero is the number of the beast. 666 points to Nero's name. And I've touched on other evidences in the sermons that I hope y'all have been picking up as I've been going, at least maybe subconsciously. Now, like I said, I did consider skipping going over the external evidence, but I figured that for your benefit, it would be good to do it, for you just to have at least seen it. And there's a lot more that can be looked at than we're going to look at. I'm honing in on the main big one that people generally go to, so you can see what I'm talking about there. If you want more information on that, I do recommend Gentry's book, Before Jerusalem Fell, for that. The reason I'm doing this, ultimately, and maybe y'all are seeing at this point, as we talked about interpretive, different type of interpretive methods, and then we've been looking at proofs for early dating in the text, and now we're going to show this. It's so that you, when you study this phenomenal book, you're able to study it fully aware of what's going on, because when you study Revelation, not many people, well, maybe some people just read the book, but a lot of people start reading, what do other people have to say about it? So that you've got a way to understand where they're coming from, and so you can kind of weed out, maybe you can find the nuggets in what they say. So you can find those golden nuggets. And I want y'all to be able to find those. So trying to polish your lens for understanding. So go ahead there, Mark. So a word on the external evidence. Now some make, and when I run into this, people, I mean, literally, this guy quotes this other guy. Basically, well, Sweet's not quoting, but you see these people making these just blanket statements, like H.B. Sweet saying early Christian tradition is practically unanimous in assigning the apocalypse to the last years of Domitian. The problem is that statement is an utter falsehood. Now, if you're reading his work and you come across that, right, you're like, oh, well, how many people are actually going to go read the church fathers, look at things like the Muratorium Canon, look at all those evidences to see if he's actually telling that this is true? Not many, unless you're a scholar who's, you get paid for that, or you've just got a lot of time on your hands. And most people don't have the time to go check the truth of such a statement. However, the thing is, it is a demonstrably false statement, what he makes. But a lot of people follow this hook, lines, and sinker. I mean, numerous scholars have shown, go ahead to the next slide there. Numerous scholars have shown that tradition was not unanimous for such a late dating. Here's just four. Shepherd Hermas, it was, you know, there's some discussion on the date, the earliest possible, perhaps possible, idea when that was written. Was 8080. Now, if it was written 8080, there's no way, you know, what's pointed to there is things that are obviously drawn from Apocalypse, John's Apocalypse. So if it was written in 80, there's no way Apocalypse was written in 95. Then there's Papias, the Muratorium Canon, which lists, I'm not going to tell you what all those are. I'm just pointing out, the point of this slide is to show you these do not support the statement that Sweet made. It is not unanimous. So next slide. So this is why Irenaeus. Boiling it all down, it comes down to one guy. One guy. one guy. I mean, so we've got this quote, the so-called unanimity of father's witness, of the father's witness on the matter stems entirely from the Irenaean source. And when people say fathers, they're referring to the early church fathers. It's a term we inherited. But the problem with Irenaeus, I'm going to show you, is what Reagan Ewing, and I pointed out his thesis that he wrote on this, and I draw from it heavily tonight, was, he said, is basically the linchpin of the early date, Irenaeus, is a historically questionable, grammatically ambiguous, single source that has become a among the church fathers, serving for many as the decisive clue to the date. One guy, right? Really, and then now they build a lot of other stuff. So come on, next slide there. So this has been observed by a number of scholars. Here's some of those scholars who point out. I'm not just saying, okay, a lot of scholars say this. You know, a lot of scholars say that. Well, here's some of them. Ewing, he specifically points out. All later witnesses, Albert Bell, all later witnesses to this date seem to derive directly from Irenaeus. Milton Terry, when we scrutinize the character and the extent of this evidence, in other words, the external witness, it seems clear that no very great stress can safely be laid upon it, for it all turns upon the single testimony of Irenaeus. And then T. Randall, Eusebius and Jerome in the 4th century do not strengthen what they merely repeat. So when you point at somebody and say, well, this person holds it in addition to this person, but they're just quoting somebody else. That these are not historical witnesses. These are people that are just saying they're just saying what somebody else said. All right. And then David Chilton, I like what he says. He sums it up. Irenaeus is the only source for this late dating of Revelation. All other sources are simply quoting from him. We were looking at the ESV Study Bible. I don't know if y'all use it, but ESV Study Bible, for example. Very disappointing. I'm not going to throw it out, but I was very upset to see that it holds to an 80-95 dating. It's disappointing when I come across those type of things. It's disappointing. I'm disappointed in the scholars who did that. It's sad to me. It's sad to me. So let's look at what Irenaeus wrote that caused all this fuss. Go ahead. I'm going to kind of lay this out for you as evidence. Irenaeus, here's some facts on what Irenaeus did. He wrote in Greek. The only extant copy of his work, interestingly, is a translation. It's a Latin translation from the Greek, which has since been translated in English. We do have some fragments of the Greek text, though, thankfully, including the passage in question, which was preserved in Eusebius's Ecclesiastical Histories, which was a 4th century writing, but it was written in Greek. And so we have the Greek from Irenaeus, so we can look at actually what was originally written rather than a translation of what was written and then read the English of the Latin translation of the Greek. And you see where that can really go wrong when you're trying to determine something as particular as this. Next slide, please, Mark, so I can kind of show it to you. All right, this is the actual quote of Irenaeus that Eusebius in his church histories quotes, and you'll find this in the Antonicene Fathers, actually volume 1. It says, we will not, however, incur the risk of pronouncing positively as to the name of Antichrist, for if it were necessary that his name should be distinctly revealed in this present time, it would have been announced by him who beheld the apocalyptic vision. For that was seen, no very long time since, but almost in our day towards the end of Domitian's reign. Now, the underlying portion up there, it's really the, that's what's pointed to by your late daters. And if you're just looking at this English translation, or even the Latin translation, and that's as far as you go, it seems pretty straightforward what Irenaeus was saying. I still would not weight this over the biblical evidence. For that was seen. What is that? For that was seen. The highlighted word there is really where the controversy stems. And see, for y'all are going to be going, how could we ever possibly know this? It's because you have me as your pastor, and I get into the details. All right? Next slide, please. As we consider this, we need to know that there are some issues underlying this translation. I'm going to show you what those issues were. Ewing sums it up as this: while our only extant complete text of the work containing this passage is in Latin, Eusebius preserves Irenaeus' Greek. In the Latin, the ambiguity is removed. So the Greek word is kind of, there's some ambiguity there on how it could be translated. But the scribe who translated removed that ambiguity, made a decision, and translated it into the Latin based on that, removing that ambiguity that you would find in the Greek. But the Greek, we've got to look at the original. If we didn't have the Greek, we would just have to say, well, that's what Irenaeus says, and then we'd agree to disagree. The thing is, we do have the Greek. Go ahead, next slide there, Mark. All right, here it is. Grace, would you like to read that for us? I'm just messing. Come on. That was a great look, by the way. That was. Yeah, I mean, seriously. But here's that word again. Here's that word again. That's the highlighted word that needs to be considered. Mark, go ahead and flip it. So the big issue in translation. The subject of the statement is simply subsumed in the verb. In other words, the verb includes the subject in it, and you know what the subject would be, the referent there would be, because it's within the verb. The subject of the statement is simply subsumed in the verb, and there is therefore no grammatical indicator as to the referent. It could be the apocalypse, or it could be John himself. In other words, the English could just as easily be, he was seen. Instead of it was seen, it could be he was seen. The word actually is he, she, or it was seen. And context tells you whether it's a he, she, or an it when you do your translation. So go ahead, next slide there, Mark. So, they're both perfectly legitimate translations if you're just looking at that word. Context has got to be considered. He was seen or it was seen. Which is it? So next slide there, Mark. All right. So this is, I put this together just because you could kind of, so you could see the impact. It would have been announced by him who beheld the apocalyptic vision, for he or it / that was seen no very long time since. Now, you see, if it's referring to he, or versus referring to it, can you see how that makes a big difference in what is being said? If it said it was seen, what's it referring to? The apocalyptic vision. If it's he was seen, it's referring to what? And if it's saying it was seen or that was seen, it's saying that that vision was seen no very long time since, but almost in our day towards the end of Domitian's reign, which would be in circa 80-95. Right? However,
why couldn't it mean he and it? Like, for instance, it could mean the same thing as he if he's talking about a supernatural being, which the Antichrist is a supernatural being.
No, he's talking about John. See, him who beheld the apocalyptic vision.
Oh, I see.
So that would be the he. That would be the he. That would be what he would refer to. It would just refer to the apocalyptic vision. Right. So you can see where this is kind of, Brick, you're going, huh? I mean, really, the Greek, there's a little bit of ambiguity there, how we understand that as far as a proof text. Context, however, it's laid out. If it was he, then him who beheld the apocalyptic vision is a referent. If it was it or that, then the apocalyptic vision is a referent. Grammatical rules alone, this is what I want you to understand. Grammatical rules alone could have it go either way. Either way. Which is another reason context is key. So next slide there. So a few arguments in favor of he was seen. And as that's the position I'm pushing for, that's what I'm going to show you. I've got five of them that I wanted to run through. There are more. I just selected five out of various ones. The first one there is Irenaeus had a tendency to use heorathe in reference to persons more commonly than visions or things. J.F.A. Hort makes that observation. Now, here again, you've got a guy, and feel free to go scour Irenaeus' work for that word and see how he uses it. We've got scholars out here do that. J.F.A. Hort, that's his observation. In this case, okay, we'll go with it. And he's considered a very credible scholar. So the second one there, the larger context of the passage explicitly speaking to those who have seen John face to face. Now, that's the larger context. And speaking to those who have seen John face to face. So next slide there. Now, concerning that second one, when we read what Eusebius writes versus what we have in the Latin, we see that Eusebius, he leaves out the first part. He leaves out the part that is translated, "We will not, however, incur the risk of pronouncing positively as to the name of Antichrist." And because that snippet's left out, that affects it. He picks up with the "but if" or "for if" there. And so leaving out a critical bit for interpretation. Whenever you interpret, especially in something like the Greek, where you need more information to be able to know if it's a he or an it was seen, you know, leaving out important information, it can hinder it. You know, the larger context is important. So go ahead. Gentry explains, this was pretty good, I thought. Kenneth Gentry. He says, Irenaeus' argument regards the identity of the person represented by 666, that'd be the Antichrist, is what he's talking about. There's some discussion on that, if Antichrist is even the right name. I like it. Gentry just says the person represented by 666. And this context seems to demand that Irenaeus refers to John, whom he believes to have lived almost to his, Irenaeus' own time. When Irenaeus says it would have been announced by him, it would most logically follow that his next statement should be translated, "for he was seen no very long time since, but almost in our day." So basically, Irenaeus is saying that if John wanted us to know who 666 represented, which, by the way, we looked at that last week, he would have told us. He would have told us as he lived a long time after writing Revelation, after writing the Apocalypse, almost to Irenaeus' own time. Now, Irenaeus was born circa 130 or 140, so John was not that old. So the "almost" is definitely in there. You know, almost, I mean, we're talking a lot of years. That's the next slide there. So three, grammatical arguments that the apocalyptic vision is the referent due to being the immediately preceding noun falls flat. The apocalyptic vision is part of the whole immediately preceding subject, him who beheld the apocalyptic vision. Now some will argue that the noun that immediately precedes the verb in this case would be the referent. And so then you got to say, well, what actually is the noun? All right. So is the noun referring to he who saw the apocalypse? This here.
It comes immediately before.
He who saw the apocalypse, or is it referring to the apocalypse? Well, basically, he who saw the apocalypse is a whole idea. A whole subject. The immediate referent is him who beheld the apocalyptic vision. I mean, so you can go back and forth on this, and people are going to argue it. And whether we come to an absolute solution is not really so important. Whether it's a he or an it. That's not absolutely critical. Go ahead and flip the slide there. Let's move past that one. So John is the referent. It fits better the logic of the passage. So let's see what some of these other folks have said on this. S.H. Chase, the statement that the vision was seen at the close of Domitian's reign supplies no reason why the mysterious numbers should have been expounded by him who saw the apocalypse, had he judged such an exposition needful. And if, on the other hand, we refer to Heorathe to St. John, the meaning is plain and simple. Next slide. Let's continue this. Can y'all read that?
Yeah.
Okay. So had it been needful that the explanation of the name should be proclaimed to the men of our own day, that explanation would have been given to the author, or given by the author of the book. For the author was seen on earth. He lived and held converse with his disciples not so very long ago, but almost in our own generation. Thus, on the one hand, he lived years after he wrote the book, and there was an abundant opportunity for him to expound the riddle had he wished to do so. And on the other hand, since he lived on almost into our generation, the explanation, had he given it, must have been preserved to us. Okay, are y'all tracking on that, what he's saying? Consider this a way of understanding what could have been said based on the context. Based on the context. Basically, understanding who is represented by 666, he's saying that he's not even talking about the vision. He's talking about John would have explained it to us because he was alive. He was seen. We saw him around. He was up and walking. He was going around. Versus John saw it much later. It doesn't even really make sense for it to be referring to the apocalypse and not John. Next slide there. Here's another one, the fifth one. Scholars have looked at the Latin translation that we have of Irenaeus' stuff, and they say the Latin is really bad. So we've got a translator. I mean, these people know more than I do, obviously. A couple of different folks, Mosheim and Schaff, they say it's terrible. They labeled it as barbarous, like just bad Latin. In other words, he just was bad at translating. And so people who use the Latin version to determine whether this should be a proof for a late date or not, they're operating from an inferior translation. It puts the pressure on that one scribe to have made the right decision in his translating. If that scribe had translated it instead of "that was seen," if he had translated it as "he was seen," not many people would be arguing real hard from Irenaeus, other than Eusebius. It seems to have leaned that way with him. Eusebius did not like Revelation. But that's a whole nother thing. So if he made a mistake, and the potential is that he did, that's a lot of weight to put on that one little guy, whoever he was. Maybe he was a big guy, I don't know. Alright, next slide. Some question as to Irenaeus' reliability himself. Now, we've looked at the evidence, and I understand it was probably confusing to you. The main thing I wanted to show you was the ambiguity aspect of it. It cannot be shown that that is so reliable. It can go either way. It can go either way. To use it and say this is the main, when it boils down to it, everybody looks at this as a proof for a late date, as evidence. I'm showing you that it is not a sound witness to base that kind of thing on. It's just not strong enough. And as far as Irenaeus' witness, here's just a couple of things. He portrays James the Apostle as the same person as the brother of the Lord. He's a little bit confused. When did James the Apostle die? He died early on. Remember? And then James, the brother of the Lord, was there in Jerusalem much later. And then two, he claimed that Jesus lived between 40 and 50 years old, using so-called eyewitnesses to his claim. And everybody just kind of generally goes, yeah, that's wrong. So Irenaeus himself and his own other stuff he did was not all that accurate one way or another. The thing there is, he was not the Bible. He was not an inspired witness. He was a guy who lived many years later, many, many, many years later, just writing about what, you know, those people, kind of what he had heard, right? To try to make an argument, he wasn't even talking about the dating of the book. He was talking about why we don't know who the 666 is. Because it was so confusing to them at the time. So next slide there, Mark. Thoughts. I hope I've shown you that the Irenaeus evidence is not conclusive either way. I would not point to this and say, look, this is proof of AD 65. I would also not point to it and say, this is proof of AD 95. I would say it would go either way. There's too much in the mix. There's too much in the mix. And the confusion you feel is the confusion scholars should feel whenever they read and somebody points to Irenaeus and says, this is a solid witness. Because it's not. It's like, how are you using this guy at your base? I mean, but the thing is, it boils down to be the linchpin that makes it or breaks it to many people's position as a late date of writing. That. And G.K. Beale, and I have tremendous respect for this man, okay? And his commentary on Revelation is considered one of the finest out there. But I'm so disappointed in him. He wrote, in agreement with Sweet's 1979 commentary on Revelation, he was the guy who read that, the unanimity. That's a word that you read, but you don't really say much. You know, trying to get it to come off the tongue is not so easy, but whatever. But in order to sum up his late date conclusion, at the end of his discussion on date, he quotes Sweet, G.K. Beale does. He says, the earlier date may be right. Okay. But the internal evidence is not sufficient to outweigh the firm tradition stemming from Irenaeus. I'm sorry, Irenaeus is not firm at all. And the tradition stemming from him just builds on a non-firm foundation. It's a foundation of sand to build their castle. And the problem is that seems to be the default of so many people. So when you read AD 95, somewhere in there they're going to mention it. They're going to say a lot of other stuff, and you're going to read it, and you're going to like, that makes a lot of sense. But you pull out Irenaeus' witness, you now are into the realm of
circumstantial.
You know when you watch a cop show, right? You've got your hard evidence they're looking for, and then you've got your circumstantial evidence. Well, we've got all this over here, and so we can kind of put this together and come to this conclusion. There's a reason that doesn't stand up in court, right? Well, in the case of this, you remove Irenaeus and they're pretty much going on circumstantial evidence. And Irenaeus was basically quoting from other people anyway, stuff he had heard in his own witness. So there you go. I've shown you some of the hard stuff. Go ahead and flip it there. I say the hard stuff, and I mean that the hard evidence, the stuff we see in the scriptures, I've shown that to you. We've considered some key passages from the inspired witness, what's called the internal evidence. The temple is still standing. We looked at that in detail in Revelation 11. Nero is the current emperor. We looked at that in Revelation 17. He is the one who is, based on the counting, remember? So that's from the scripture. I mean, especially, these are the two real strong ones. Because if the temple is still standing, and Nero is the emperor, and Nero killed himself in 68, and Nero's persecution kicked off at 64, and John is on Patmos because he's been exiled because of persecution, does it all start to fall into place? So when you read Irenaeus, one little statement, that is confusing to most people, unless you know Greek and you understand the Latin discussion and you can go and look at it yourself and say, huh, unless you know how to do that, scholars are going to say 80-95, Irenaeus says this, it's a strong argument, and they're going to maybe write the English and they might write the Greek and expect you just to know what that means. Which takes a lot of scholars to say, hey, we looked at that and that's just not a good argument. It's just not a good argument. I'm saying that the inspired witness, those two things right there and the way it fits so well, blows away their arguments based on Irenaeus. They just blow it away. And it really is baffling to me to see their conclusions. It's baffling to give such a tremendous amount of weight to one uninspired guy over the inspired witness of the text. He's just not a strong witness. So next slide. In sum, we have a historically questionable, and this is from Reagan Ewing, a historically questionable, grammatically ambiguous, single source that has become a unanimity among the church fathers, and this evidence is serving for many as the decisive clue to the date. Crazy. It's crazy. Do y'all understand why it's crazy? I mean, if you just at least understand that much. Now, here's the thing. Like I said, I would not use Irenaeus to try to prove it either way, because of the ambiguity there. It's just too weak of an evidence. It's just way too weak if you're trying to make an argument as important as dating. The best you could do with it is to, if there was other evidences, throw it in there and try to make an argument from this could be this, this could be this, this could be this. Maybe this all adds up to that. And we see a lot of that. But when they talk about the strength of that witness, what I want you to understand is when they point to Irenaeus, and they will, if you read in the beginnings of commentaries, even if you read in the beginnings of some of your study Bibles, perhaps, and they mention Irenaeus, know that it is not determinative one way or the other. It is not a strong argument. Whereas what's really strong is the internal witness of the Scriptures, and we need to stick to that. The only thing you can do, as far as the fathers are concerned, and those other documents that I point out, is to see what they have to say about it. Think about, okay, if there was a strong witness of church fathers to overwhelm what we looked at as far as the internal witness, it would have to be more than that one guy and a few others that are kind of taken. I mean, they point at some. I mean, it's just, I'm not going into it all now. Y'all don't want me to go into it, but it is absolutely frustrating looking at what these people do, because that sermon I preached this morning, if I listened to them, I could not have preached it. And that is frustrating. And there are a lot of pastors out there, Bible studies, all these things that are being taught from a late date, and they're getting it wrong, because they're not coming from the right time. It is critically important that we preach from the right time that it was dated. Go ahead, Sharon, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say it's kind of like saying the world is flat, because that's as far as we can see. And that's what other people say. And, you know, the sun drops off the edge every day.
So they're saying the world is flat. This is an example of why people are confused about Revelation. If you buy a Bible study that you want to teach on Revelation these days, there's a really good chance they're going to be teaching it. Matter of fact, there's a really high chance it's going to be written from the point of view of 80-95. If you listen to most pastors, they're probably going to be preaching from an 80-95. What I'm saying is that the scholarly community has really they have made a huge mistake, and it has misled a lot of teachers of the Scriptures. And it is a bad thing. It is a bad thing. Could you not tell how it worked so well this morning when I preached on Revelation 2, 1 through 7, understanding it was talking about Ephesus and around the time of AD 65? Not very long after Paul I mean, we know those people. Otherwise, we don't know them. And we have to try to figure out where it goes. And that's why you get these other interpreters that start talking about, well, it's all symbolic. Because they don't have anything to ground it in. If I didn't have anything to ground it in, there is no way I could have preached that sermon like I did this morning for you. To show you what was really going on. And so therefore knowing what the text was really trying to teach us. And that's important. So what it means is, we got some work ahead of us. Because there's not a lot of, I'm doing a lot of work to try to bring that perspective to you. And it's just going to be as we go along kind of thing. My hope and prayer is just at the end of this road, when we get to the end of the apocalypse, that you guys, a lot of the confusion has been wiped away from your minds, and that you understand what John was trying to say. And that every time you go and read Revelation for your own again, that sticks with you. And so it doesn't confound you. You're like, oh, that's talking about this. Oh, that's referring to this. That's where I want you to be when we get done with this. And I think we can go there. And preaching from an 80-65 point of view, we can get there. Preaching from an 80-95 point of view, well, go look yourself and see the kind of stuff they're writing about Revelation from that point of view. Just go look. Because we're out of time and I'm not going to go there. All right. Thank you.